I'm Byron Harris, and this is When I Got Here, Untold Immigrant Stories. On the south bank of the Rio Grande, across the border from El Paso, is a tent city known as Little Venezuela. Hundreds of refugees are camped out, hoping to be permitted entry into the United States. More than 40% of immigrants apprehended at El Paso are from Venezuela. Their encampment stretches for more than a quarter of a mile, its residents having traveled on foot from their crumbling country. Most have spent weeks trekking here, risking their lives crossing the treacherous, roadless rainforest of the Darien Gap between Colombia and Panama. They yearn to put America in their future and Venezuela behind.
Super incredibly sad because to me that's a sign of a country that's just completely falling apart. When there's so much immigration out of the country because people are running out of food.
Maria Alexandra Bacalao was born in Caracas, Venezuela. Her family left when she was 9, as they realized the country's political system was disintegrating. Now, Alexandra, Alex, is 36. Venezuela is in an even more precarious place than when she left.
Life has gone so expensive there. The supply nets, the supply chains, social safety nets, social cohesion is breaking down so much that people can't get their needs met. They can't get food. They can't get medicines. Their kids can't get an education. There's just so much in the society there that has just broken down.
Alex is a kind of citizen of the world.
My mom's originally from Spain, so she's an immigrant as well. My grandparents were immigrants. They escaped the Spanish Civil War and World War II, moved to Belgium, and then was in Belgium during World War II.
She has relatives sprinkled all over Europe and South America. After leaving Caracas, her parents, both engineers, got jobs in Vancouver, British Columbia, and then Houston, where she went to high school. By any measure, she is a resounding success, having earned a bachelor's and master's in engineering and then going on to medical school. She's already lived in several American cities.
To a degree, I feel like from everywhere, I'm from nowhere at the same time. I don't know if that makes any sense. A little bit of a citizen of the world kind of thing. I love multiple countries and hold multiple countries in my heart at the same time. And yet, I also feel times that I don't quite belong. I realize, you know, what really makes you happy is people and community.
She's found she belongs to several communities. The immigrant community, the healthcare community, and the community that is the United States. When immigrants hurt, she hurts. Although she's not from Mexico, when Mexicans are called rapists, she feels it.
It's definitely hurtful. Not because of me. It doesn't really hurt me personally. It hurts me on behalf of my fellow humans. It hurts me because I hate that my fellow human that happens to be a Mexican-American man is going to be walking down the street and somebody's going to view them as a potential threat and is going to walk across the street to avoid them. It hurts me because that particular population is going to be judged negatively and not going to be offered the same opportunities as somebody else who looks a little bit differently than they do, even though they're just as deserving, they have the same qualifications. So personally, it doesn't necessarily hurt me, but it hurts me on behalf of my fellow humans. And I'm not from Central America, I'm not from Mexico. I can empathize with them, perhaps a little bit more easily than I otherwise would have because of my story. The longer I'm here, obviously, at times I start to feel like I don't quite belong, are less and less and less. Definitely remember in high school, I definitely witnessed quite a few incidences of anti-immigrant sentiment. And I was told that some of the opportunities I had, I got into some colleges that I got into, was because I'm Latina and not because I was actually deserving of these opportunities. That was really hurtful. Anti-Latino slang written on like bathroom walls and things like that in my high school. So stuff like that makes you feel like you don't really belong. But it's been a long time since I've experienced that.
She's both a physician and a medical researcher. She sees much of American society through the prism of that community. And although the healthcare system is far from perfect, she believes Americans don't know how good they have it.
I feel like I see this a lot on social media about people being very disparaging and very harsh to the U.S. healthcare system. It's just awful. Everything's so much better in Europe, and people don't die like they do here in Europe, and blah 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 blah. And like just basically saying that our healthcare system, educational system, are terrible. They're like the worst thing ever. And from my perspective, I don't think they necessarily grew up with that. Maybe there's more tendency to take it for granted, because I don't know if they know how good they have it. Yes, it can be improved, but I want to start it from a place, bring people together, start it from a place of like, what we have is good, but it doesn't necessarily work for everyone. Let's try and make that better. Rather than like being self-defeating attitude of, oh, everything is terrible, because I don't feel like that's as good of a place to like bring everybody together to improve things. When you're coming from such a negative perspective, negative attitude towards things. Because when you look at things, it's like, yes, the healthcare system here, I work in a healthcare system, so I see this every day. Yes, it can use some work. Yes, it doesn't work for everybody. But at the same time, there's a much better safety net here than there is in Latin America. And so there's a lot to be said about that. And I don't think we necessarily appreciate the fact that we already have that background to improve on. Like, we don't have to, everything's terrible. If you approach it from everything's terrible, then that tendency would be to destroy everything you have and build it from scratch. And I just don't think that's going to be way more difficult to do. And it's going to be counterproductive, I think.
As COVID strengthened its grip on the country, she became aware of the politics of the epidemic.
Of course, COVID got politicized. But I also feel like the pandemic has also changed things in a way, because it also caused people to become more independent in nature. I've seen this a lot on Twitter, like people who are identified as liberal now identify as independent because they don't agree with some of the COVID policies, like lockdowns and things like that, or like mandates of various kinds. And because in their assessment of the cost and benefit analysis, it doesn't make sense for them. Personally, it's definitely encouraged me to look at things a little bit less politically, because like with COVID, the issues, COVID policy are so complicated, and they're not just scientific. They also have to do with urban planning. They have to do with ethics. What do we owe each other as humans? How do we balance competing needs of different people? How do we weigh pros and cons to different people? They should, of course, be grounded in sound science, but that sound science is, of course, difficult to do. They're difficult scientific questions to answer. And so you have to look at it in a very objective way. This caused me to look at other things in a more objective way too. But I also feel like the pandemic has also changed things in a way, because it also caused people to become more independent in nature. You would think of it as just a public health issue, but it's really not. It's a public health issue primarily, but it also goes into other areas of society. Like COVID policy, it goes into areas of like ethic, like how do we balance, I think I alluded to this last time, how do we balance safety versus freedoms? How do we balance the protections for vulnerable population versus the economic damage that could hurt another portion of the population and things like that? So there's a lot of like philosophy, ethics, policy that go into it too. So I think because of that nature of COVID that expands beyond the purely scientific, I don't think it could help but to be politicized, to be honest. And the scientific questions they're looking to answer, like how effective are masking? How effective are our lockdowns? How effective are the vaccinations? Those are actually surprisingly difficult questions to answer scientifically. And so the science was changing and evolving, and I think that also confused a lot of people.
In healthcare, immigration and medicine can become closely intertwined. A border is a heartbreaking barrier when you're sick and a potential caregiver is on the other side.
I had this one patient, really bad rheumatoid arthritis. She's from Mexico. Even though she's young, a lot of her joints already, unfortunately, pretty much have end-stage arthritis. And so there's only so much that me as a rheumatologist can do for her, because our medicines can prevent the joints from getting worse, but the damage that's already been done is done. She needs a lot of help at home. There's a lot of things that she's not really able to do for herself. And so she would love nothing more than her mother to be able to come over here and help her. But given her current immigration laws, it's extremely hard. And so like I reached out to her social worker and talked to her and see like what we can do. And then she essentially said that maybe we can send a letter to the consulate, but there's really nothing much that we can really do. tell the situation and like very little that we could do to help her. It was really sad and kind of discouraging.
Alex's third community is the one we all live in, the United States. The events of January 6th were a reminder to her of how fragile democracy is.
Very scary, because I think what scared me the most was the fact that they were denying the election results. And that's a common tactic that you see in authoritarian regimes, is delegitimization of the democratic process. And that's what January 6th was all about, at least in my mind. A lot of that was, we're storming the Capitol because we don't think these actual fair elections, the American people have spoken through, we think those are inaccurate. That to me was really scary, for sure.
It reminded her of what had happened in Venezuela with dictator Hugo Chavez, whose behavior prompted her family to leave home.
Seeing what my family went through and my friends went through with Hugo Chavez, like seeing pretty similar rhetoric in Trump was very scary. Even though Chavez is more socialist and Trump was obviously more on the right wing, the kind of like more authoritarian populist rhetoric, to me those were almost like two sides of the same coin. And they both can have similar end consequences of destroying social ties and decreasing individual freedoms and things like that, ultimately hurting the economy. Fortunately, Trump did not become Chavez, and I think part of that is also because we have such strong checks and balances here and such strong institutions that I think prevented that, a lot of that. Back when like Trump won, I was kind of thinking, you know, this guy seems kind of a megalomaniac. I'm getting somewhat like Latin American dictator vibes about this guy. And so I was thinking, if it comes to a situation in which he decides to do things like suspend the Constitution and continue running for more terms and then install his crony as his successor rather than have like a free and fair election, if that were to happen, I think I would have probably told my husband and encouraged my parents, okay, we have to leave. But definitely during the Trump administration, I definitely was keeping my eye out for those type of situations.
The recently completed midterm elections, though, confirmed her expectations that common sense would prevail.
I didn't think there was going to be like a red wave or a blue wave. I thought it was going to be, based on what I had seen on like among the group of people I interact with and even on like social media and Twitter, I knew that it was going to probably be pretty similar, pretty much a wash, not too different from what happened in 2020. Maybe the red wave was going to be like a little bit, if it was going to happen, it's going to be more like a red ripple. It's just kind of what happened. The Republicans did take control of the House, but the Senate most likely will remain in the Democrat hands.
Red wave, blue wave. Refugees in Little Venezuela. Immigrants and health care. All contribute to a complex matrix of how Alex views her country.
What America means to me is perhaps a little, as an immigrant, it's a little bit different than it means to somebody who was born and raised here. There is no one immigrant experience, and we're a hugely diverse group of people. We come to U.S. for different reasons. When you think of the archetype of the immigrant, you think of somebody that comes here either to escape poverty, escape persecution, things like that, but that's not always the case. People come here for opportunity all the time, and that can look very different. It could be educational opportunity, career opportunities, or maybe they meet someone who's from America and there's opportunity for like relationship opportunities, that kind of thing. There's so many different reasons why people come here, and so many different stories and motivations. Everybody's welcome and accepting for who you are. That is truly what I love about here. Everybody is able to succeed. I love America.
You've been listening to When I Got Here, a production of Literacy Achieves in Dallas, Texas. I'm Dion Kirby, CEO. We provide English literacy programs to hundreds of immigrant and refugee families from all over the world. We help them. We celebrate them. We invite you to tell us your immigrant stories at literacyachieves.org. Tune in next month for another episode of When I Got Here.